The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm joined now by Nina Totenberg, the NPR legal affairs correspondent, who is the author of a brand new and a wonderful book, Dinners with Ruth, a memoir of the power of friendships. I've never met Nina Totenberg. I've never actually talked to Nina Totenberg. So welcome, Nina Totenberg, and congratulations. Dinner with Ruth is really fabulous.
Hi, you. I don't know if we've ever met, but we have talked on the phone at least once that I remember.
Oh.
So obviously, you were more memorable to me than I was to you.
Well, I've forgotten that. I'm sorry. I must tell you, I think it's because I may have told you at the time. I've always been afraid of you because when I was at Justice as the youngest of Bill Smith's special assistants, Terry Eastland, one of my closest friends in the world, came in and warned us that be careful of Nina. She'll write everything down or she'll remember it. So Judy Hammerschmidt, Ron Blunt, Tex Lazar, we all had a healthy respect for you, Nina, and I just cowered. I just stayed away from you.
Well, that's very flattering. I was very young then and probably a lot scarier than I am today.
Oh, I think you're not scary at all after having read Dinners with Ruth. I must say, though, my favorite anecdote among crossover people, people that you know and I know, is when Chuck Cooper spots you in the back of the room you've infiltrated into a Brad Reynolds a closed meeting, and he escorts you out, and you give your phone number to all the assembled DOJ people.
And let it be said that Chuck Cooper and I have remained friends ever since.
Well, you do seem to get along with all of my buddies. It's remarkable that people think that Washington walks around with knives hidden, ready to plunge into the backsides of people with whom you disagree. Your book is a great testament to the reality of Washington being or having been an amiable place where people could disagree agreeably.
I think that's true. I tried to make it that way. One of the things I didn't want this ever to be was a score-settling book. Anybody can write those, but you'd rather not live a life that way. And so my object here was to tell a little bit about the court, to tell some about me, to tell some about especially my women friends, because people of my generation, women of my generation came of age and started trying to have professional lives when we weren't trying to break a glass ceiling. We were just trying to get a foot in the door. And I think it's worth it for young women today and young men to know that it was unbelievably different that not that long ago.
Yeah, Nina Totenberg, I was out on a boat last night with a Marine Corps colonel retired, an HBS executive still working, and my wife of 40 years. I couldn't stop talking about Dinners with Ruth because their world is not my world and your world. And I just couldn't stop telling them. And it's simply winsome. It's a winsome, wonderful, revealing look at not just Justice Ginsburg, though that is the focus, but at a time and a place and actually the last 45 years in Washington, D.C. But I'm going to begin with a funny question. Just because you've watched so many Supreme Court arguments, you know so many of the justices, you know so many of the legal people. If you had to recommend a Supreme Court advocate today, someone called you up and their company is on the line, they have to argue before the Supreme Court, who would it be?
I guess it would probably be Paul Clement.
You and I said the same thing. I got asked that question a couple of years ago, and I've never met Paul Clement or spoken to him, but I said, Paul Clement, tell people why.
Well, because he's just, if he weren't such a nice, an intelligent and good guy, I would say that he was an idiot savant of an advocate. I mean, by that I don't mean that he's an idiot. I mean that even when he was a baby advocate, he came to the Justice Department with John Ashcroft, for whom he had worked on the Senate Judiciary Committee, I think. And he was in his young 30s. And Ted Olson was the Solicitor General and had just won Bush versus Gore for President Bush, by then President Bush. And Ashcroft, I think, actually wanted Paul to be Solicitor General, and the compromise was that he would be deputy, which he was for 4 years, and then he became Solicitor General on his own. But as Ted Olson would say, there, you know, Paul is just an amazing advocate, and he is not a, you know, when he worked for the government, he represented the government. When he works for the Catholic Church, he represents the Catholic Church. Do I think that is closer to an approximation of his views? Yes, I do. But he was a just a bang-up advocate for the government, and so was Ted Olson. They both represented, they both defended the McCain-Feingold law and won in the Supreme Court, and it fell apart years later, and they represent different interests now that they're in private practice, but they that didn't stop them from being the best advocates possible for their client at the time, and their client at the time was the United States government.
You just named two of the four of the greatest Supreme Court advocates of my generation, the other two being the now Chief Justice John Roberts, and the fourth being, it'll come to me, I just forgot his name. And there are four, and they were always, I get calls, and when the Chief Justice was in private practice at Hogan, I would say, go get him. And now when I get calls, I say, go get Paul Clement, because, oh, Ken Starr, Judge Starr is no longer practicing. They were great Supreme Court advocates because they just are at ease. And that, I bring that up because of your Walter Dellinger story on page 130, and God bless the late Walter Dellinger, who was a great man of the law with whom I disagreed often, but he mixed up the names of Justices O'Connor and Ginsburg in his first argument. That's over practicing, Nina. That's, don't you think that's what it was? He was overprepared. He had thought about it so much. I'm not going to mix them up. I'm not going to mix them up. I'm not going to mix them up. And he mixed them up and they were not happy.
I don't even know if it was the first, his first argument. It just was maybe the first time he faced the two of them on the court.
You're right. You're right. Yeah.
And he said, I mean, I've done this. I've said North Carolina when my script says South Carolina. I don't know what happens. It's a, you know, in a less than ladylike expression, it's a brain fart.
Yeah. Happens to me like on a daily basis, Nina Totenberg. I mean, on a daily basis, 3 hours of radio, you're going to do it. Your buddy Steve never makes a mistake, Inskeep, and I really hate that. But I make mistakes every day. Let me go on now to the, what the essence of Dinners with Ruth is. And I remind you of the Frank Luntz rule. We've got to say the title Dinners with Ruth seven times for people to remember Dinners with Ruth and order Dinners with Ruth. And I want to tell my friends on the center, right, and the right, this book will charm you and inform you, and you'll be better for having read it. I said that most recently about Evan Thomas's One. Evan is a friend. One is about Justice O'Connor. And it, as Dinners with Ruth does for Justice Ginsburg, one did for Justice O'Connor. And together they do what is only very infrequently done. They give you a glimpse of the real world of the Supreme Court. And you know what? So much better than I do. I know some of the justices, but not as friends. I mean, colleague John Roberts, an old colleague, Chief Justice Thomas and Stephen Breyer sat for interviews. And Justice Gorsuch has been spent time with, but I don't know them like you know them. And you are a great storyteller, and you humanize them, but especially Judge Justice Ginsburg. Did you intend that when you began?
Well, you know, I got talked into writing this book first by the CEO Jonathan Karp of Simon & Schuster, and next by my husband, who had always said he didn't want me to write a book because he would have to share even more of my time away from home. And when Jonathan Karp had this idea to write about the women of my generation in particular, with a focus on Justice Ginsburg, I mean, let's not pretend she meant an enormous amount to me as a friend, but it also sells books. But I don't want you to forget the second half of the title, which is Dinners with Ruth, a memoir on the power of friendships. And that's the other half of it. It's a memoir on the power of friendships. And I couldn't figure out how I could write a memoir. I got too much life to try to fit in, and I didn't know how I could do it. And Jonathan Karp came up with this idea, and I thought it was a good idea, but I wasn't going to do it because my husband already, I already come home late too often, and he's never pleased with that, even though he's a trauma surgeon.
Hey, it's a fabulous book, and I am glad that Jonathan Karp, who green-lighted a book for me once for no reason whatsoever other than he thought it was a good idea, and I'm glad he did. And I'll talk with you at length about this. I think every year, every life has a best year and a worst year. It seems maybe your best year was your courtship with Dr. Rhines, and maybe you've had a lot of worst years because you had a husband die and close friends die. And we're going to talk about that. Let me begin by setting the stage, though. Do you know Barbara Franklin or Bobby Kilberg? These are Washington, D.C. women, and they're women that I know. And Lynn Cheney and Connie Horner. I've worked with and closely around very strong women since I was a kid in D.C. in 83. But you seem to have worked with everybody in D.C. since 1973. Am I right about that?
I think that's an overstatement. I worked with everybody you knew and liked.
Yes. Yeah, Ted Olson and I'm just sure Ken Starr. But I want to tell you one story to set the stage about Judge Ginsburg as I knew her and why I had a very soft place in my heart for her. When I became a clerk on the D.C. Circuit in 1983, I arrived and my judge, Roger Robert, had a stroke. And we had 4 months of incredible boredom, my co-clerk Terry Ross and I, ahead of us because he was going to be out for 6 months and George McKinnon was gone. And four judges got together, Judge Ginsburg among them, Judge Scalia, Bork, and Skelly Wright, and they said, we will put these two clerks to work. And they all gave us cases, included us in their conferences. We became their clerks for 4 months. She was the most gracious lady ever to someone with whom, obviously, she would not have picked me as a clerk. Roger Robb did. And then George McKinnon came. And I just have always told people, there's just nobody nicer in Washington, D.C. than Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And did anyone ever have a contrary opinion?
I'm thinking, not that I know of, but you said something there, Hugh, that I think is not 100% true. She would have hired, if not you, someone like you, and she did. She had conservative clerks.
You're probably right. They were not there that year, but you're probably right because
and I think one of the sadder things about the current Supreme Court is that I don't actually know if the liberals have any conservative clerks. My suspicion is they don't because there are really only three of them, and the other six are hiring only conservative clerks, as far as I know now.
That's interesting. That's unfortunate. That's very unfortunate for the law, but it also reflects the pipelines from which they draw. There's a whole book to be written on how clerks become clerks. I applied for and did not receive a Supreme Court clerkship off of the D.C. Circuit. I'm not bitter about that because I was not as credentialed as these other people. But today, that's bad. What did you make? By the way, it's not in the book. And you didn't deal with the leak or the threat to Justice Kavanaugh. The book had to go to print. Do you think we'll ever know who did the leaking, Nina Totenberg? And you're a journalist who loves leaks, but you had standards about sourcing that you articulate, which I wish everyone did. What'd you make about the leak in Dobbs?
Well, in truth, it's probably the only major scoop I'm glad I didn't get. Because I do think that whoever did it did something unethical. And I'm not quite sure in furtherance of what. If I knew in furtherance of what, I suppose maybe I'd have a better idea of who had leaked it. But sometimes people do tell you things that just because they want to show that they know something. My guess is that they won't find out who the leak is. There's always a chance. And And some of it depends on how much the court wants to sort of knuckle down and act in a very kind of, I guess I would say, police state-ish kind of way. Because if you do that to the nth degree, you might figure it out. But then that would ruin the institution even more.
Well, there's an interesting passage in Dinners with Ruth, a memoir of the powers of friendship, when you were subpoenaed. And you took the position I would take and have taken, by the way, with an investigator from Congress and lawyers who showed up. I told them that their Harvard law professors would be embarrassed by the attempt that they were making to get a journalist to discuss his or her sources. And I told them to pound sand. And they went away eventually, as did your tormentors. And I really appreciate that you had Floyd Abrams come to your defense. And that is worth reading for a lawyer. Let me go get to the heart of this. So this is a book about living. And as I said, every life has a best year and a worst year. Your best year may have been the courtship that you described with Dr. David Rines. And I want to give him a shout out. He is a magnificent figure in this book. All 6'3" of him standing in the way of paparazzi and in the inquisitive, attempting to get to Justice Ginsburg at dinner. But I really think that time with Senator Floyd Haskell, after he has fallen on the ice and hit his head, is illustrative of what people don't know about people that they feel free to criticize. I had no idea about that. How hard was that to write?
How hard was what to write?
The chronicle of his suffering and decline over, 4 years?
Yeah, almost five.
Five.
It was much harder to live through.
Okay, well put.
In the score settling department that I decided not to put in the book, but I will share with you, the advice that Ruth gave me at the time, which I say in the book, Dinners with Ruth, a memoir on the power of friendships.
Well done.
I will learn to say this over and over again, I guess. But the advice that she gave me when I was sort of getting wrung out, spending time at the hospital, she said, you have to go back to work. You have to maintain who you are so that when he comes home, you are still you and able to take care of him. And it was probably the best advice anybody gave me during that time period, because I felt so guilty about not being there all the time. But she made me see that wasn't, as long as I went every day for an hour or so, I didn't have to stay there all day. He was in another world a good deal of the time. And they did think he would recover. They didn't know how much. And I knew that when he came home, I had to be able to take care of him. And it does take a village. Koki and Linda and their husbands would come a couple of times a week. They would bring dinner. We would have a dinner party right in our own dining room just to keep my spirits up and his spirits up. He was learning to walk again.
It is Nina Totenberg. This book, the subtitle, A Memoir on the Powers of Friendships, it could have been the title, because it's a lot more than Justice Ginsburg. It is about friendship and what you do and do not do. And it's about struggling with long and sometimes terminal illnesses, both your own. I mean, I didn't know you'd been run over by a motorboat. Honestly, that's news to me. There aren't a lot of people running around D.C. who've been run over by a motorboat on their honeymoon and live to tell about it. I'm jumping ahead of my interview outline here, but you're damned lucky to be alive.
I am damned lucky to be alive, and I'm damned lucky I married a trauma surgeon.
Yes.
Because he helped, he supervised the surgery.
He washed and he scrubbed in.
Yes. He scrubbed in.
And then you brought the fisherman and his boys in, the boys on the tire who saw it. I'm not going to give that story away. People have to read it. I'm back to my outline. What I love about this book, How DC Works. I'm abroad and my wife of 40 years has a medical incident. And she gets care because Elena Nachman, Ruth Marcus, Jamie Gangel, and Tom Cotton see to it. It's just one of my favorite stories. This is how DC works. You're abroad, you're gone, and your book makes manifest. It's all about your friends in DC, right?
It is absolutely about your friends. But that, you know, Hugh, that's not special to DC. It's your family and friends who make a life.
Yes.
You don't have one or the other, and if you're lucky, both. You don't have much of a life.
But you know who your friends are when you're in trouble and you need help right away and you're not there. You know who they are. And boy, you were Chokoki, a friend, and you're the Wertheimers and the Robert. I mean, your dinners are remarkable. Cokie Roberts died in 2019 after her breast cancer returned and she fought hard. Marty Ginsburg died in 2010. It was another long goodbye that you lived through. Justice Ginsburg died on September 18th, 2020, and it's touching. It's almost tear-inducing to read about how you and David took care of her. And by the way, your husband's medical ethics are second to none in the compartmentalization that he adopted vis-a-vis his treatment of the justice in your friendship with her. I just think it's an amazing book, Nina. And
you're so kind.
No.
I will say this about David. I have had friends who tell me finally, they'll say, well, my husband has whatever sort of cancer. And I'll call up David and I'll say, David, did you know that so-and-so has cancer? And do you need to call him? He says, the answer is almost always, Nina, I've known for the last year.
It's just, well, once a doctor is available in D.C., doctors get called. I want to make sure you give one anecdote as a tease. For this, and it's just Justice Ginsburg and Justice Sotomayor go horseback riding in Colorado Springs. And all right, you tell what you want to tell. Don't give away too much because people have to buy Dinners with Ruth if they want to read the whole thing. But it's pretty freaking funny.
So we're going to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. I'm supposed to interview her there. And Ruth says to David, what is there to do in Colorado Springs? It's not her circuit. And he says, well, you can go horseback riding. And she says, oh, I'd love to go horseback riding. I have all the gear. I love horseback riding. And from behind her, another voice says, I want to go too. And it's Sonia Sotomayor. So David reserves, I think, 7 horses. He knows they're going to be marshals. He, reserves one for him, one for his daughter, who lives in Colorado, Alyssa, and then maybe 3 marshals and the 2 justices. Well, the head marshal is very ticked off when he finds out about this, and he says, we need 12 because we need, special this and special that to save their lives, and so they decide to go on a different ride because they have 12 horses. Now they can't. And they're riding in the Garden of the Gods, which is a beautiful place to
wonderful
ride.
Wonderful place, yeah.
You don't gallop. And Ruth says, "Why are we walking? I want to gallop." And they say, "No, you can't gallop here." But at that point, the head marshal, he's not a good rider, and his horse starts kicking at Ruth's horse. And David rides up to the front and he says, your horse just missed kicking the justice. You take my horse. I'll take your horse. And you make sure she stays safe.
It's an amazing part of the miniseries that ought to come out of this. Now, we do have differences on the law. And if we were going to talk about the law, we would talk at length about where we agree and disagree. I don't want to do that. That's a different book. I want to talk and close our conversation by talking about a quote here. You're talking about an old Irish guy, a fixture in D.C., very powerful. Quote, sometimes he was mentally sharp and wanted to be told all the court gossip that I could offer. Other times he was just an old man sitting in bed. You're not talking about the president of the United States. You're not talking about David Bazelon. You're talking about William Brennan. And I just think this is a book about aging Nina Totenberg, as well as a book about it's a book about Justice Ginsburg. It's a book about friendship. It's a book about Justice Breyer and his wife cleaning your kitchen after the disaster. It's a book about everyone who has friends and knows things. But that part, everybody gets old. Everybody is leaving here alone and they're not carrying anything with them. Has anyone else who's read this said this is quite the meditation on aging and dying?
No, you're the first one. You really are. But you're one of the first interviews I'm doing. So, and it's more than that. I always, when I walk into a room full of people and I don't know many people, I look around for the oldest person in the room. Because chances are nobody is seeking them out, and they are more interesting and have more life stories, and you will learn more from them than you will from anybody else in the room who's looking over their shoulder to see if there's somebody more important that they could go talk to.
Oh, that's not in the book, and that's a life lesson? Oh, I just had that occasion with Judge Webster, who I've had an opportunity to serve with and talk to many times, but I saw him recently after COVID was lifted. He's 99 years old, and he was out. I wanted to talk to him. Now, he can't hear very well, but I wanted to talk to him because talk about a life, right? That's an amazing life. My other interview today was Dr. Kissinger in about 8 hours about his new book on leadership. And I'll talk to him for as long as he wants to talk to me because he knows things that neither I nor you nor anyone else knows. And not many more times to talk to him about that. That is a great life lesson, Nina Totenberg. Do the young journalists listen to you at all? I mean, do you hold court? You talk about having the couch over at NPR land. Do they come and listen to you still?
Some do. Some think I'm a bit of a fuddy-duddy because I actually do believe you that that my opinions about the law are relatively unimportant. I'm a reporter. I don't have a column. I actually don't care about my opinions enough to have a column. So there are a lot of people these days who disagree with that. And those who do think I'm a bit of a fuddy-duddy.
Well, I think they ought to seek you out for not just the stories they'll want to hear about the Anita Hill hearings or all the other controversies with which you have been involved, but for just some absolute fabulous advice on living life. And if you want to understand the court, I teach con law every other year. I'm tenured, so they can't get rid of me. I'm senior man in the area. They now have to read One and Dinners with Ruth because it's the real Supreme Court. And Nina Totenberg, thank you for joining me and giving me one of your first interviews. Congratulations on a fabulous book.
Thank you so much for having me, Hugh. We shall meet in person someday.
I hope so. After October, I'll be back in October. I hope to meet you then. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, this is Dwayne Patterson, producer of The Hugh Hewitt Show. I've known for a while now that there's been far too much of me here in the studio, and I finally needed to do something about my weight. My excuse was always that I couldn't follow a plan with the crazy schedule that I keep. I heard about PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition and how they customize their program for each client, and I decided to call. This was no problem for Rachel and the PhD team. They had me map out what my day looks like and created a plan to follow. And so far, I've lost 16 pounds already and I'm just 2 weeks in on the way to my goal of losing 45. Call PhD Weight Loss and Nutrition at 864-644-1900 and make your appointment for your consultation. The plan is simple. It's based on science and nutrition. There's no pills or injections, and they even include 80% of your food if you want it. Call them right now at 864-644-1900 or find them online at myphdweightloss.com and tell them you heard about it from Dwayne, the producer Hugh actually has on The Hugh Hewitt Show.
Welcome back, America. I am Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on this Monday morning, joined by J.D. Vance, who will be the next senator from Ohio. Good morning, J.D. How are you?
Hey, good, Hugh. How are you?
Great. Since I moderated the debate between the Republican would-be senators, I have told people, betting people would bet on J.D. Vance being the next senator. It looks that way. Tell me what your priority will be in the United States Senate, J.D. Vance.
Well, there's so much to do, Hugh, but I really think that we have to get the southern border under control. I think the effect on American hospital systems, the effect on American schools, and especially here in Ohio, the effect on the fentanyl problem from just the nonstop drug trafficking that the cartels have used the U.S. open border for. So I think that's probably priority number one. Of course, we have a terrible inflation crisis, which I think is primarily the consequence of really bad energy policy, sort of a decade of us playing fire with our American energy policy. And now finally, the liberals got full control of it and they did exactly what they said they would do. And now we've learned that we have a lot of resources here, but it's very easy to destroy the fundamental energy independence that we have in the country. So that's why, number one and number two, but there's a lot going on here and there's a lot we've got to fix.
J.D. Vance, I've also told people the reason I think I'm going to win is because while Tim Ryan is my friend and comes from Warren, Ohio, you campaigned with Donald Trump in Youngstown. The Youngstown Warren area is the second most important area to Democrats, Cuyahoga County being number one. And you were there with the president on Saturday night at the Covelli Center. How was the crowd?
The crowd was great. I mean, really, really high energy. I've done a couple of these rallies before, but never one indoors. And I don't know, something about the acoustics in there just really made the crowd seem super energetic and fired up. And you're exactly right. I mean, this is an important area for Democrats, an area they've won in the past. But I think a lot of people in Youngstown feel like the Democrats have abandoned them. I had a number of people come up to me and say, I was a Jim Trafficking guy. Now I'm a J.D. Vance guy. And that's a pretty good sign.
President Kennedy and would-be President Kerry both closed their campaigns in Courthouse Square in Trumbull County in Warren, Ohio. They just need the steelworkers. They've lost the steelworkers, J.D. Why are they voting for you?
Well, I think they're voting for me for a couple of reasons. I think, first of all, there is this perception that too many Democrats care about cultural and social issues far more than they care about a lot of workers' jobs. There's the famous quote from a steelworker in Youngstown, this is from 2016, who when asked why he was voting for Donald Trump the first time he'd ever voted for a Republican, he said, well, Democrats care about who gets to go to the bathroom with my daughter. Donald Trump cares about my job. And I'd like everybody to think of me as exactly that guy, the guy who cares about your job. I think the other thing is that, steelworkers and manufacturing union workers in general, they're not necessarily super right-wing on cultural issues, but they're also not crazy left-wing on cultural issues either. I think there's this perception that unless you talk the right way, unless you speak the language of the modern left, you're not really welcome in the Democratic Party, and that's pushed a lot of these guys away.
Yeah, J.D. Vance, in many ways, you are a compression of all of the influences in America. You're come from, of course, the story made very real in the book and the movie Hillbilly Elegy. You are also a Marine. You are also a graduate of The Ohio State University, undefeated in 3-0. You are also a Yale Law School graduate and a veteran of Silicon Valley. And now you're back in Ohio, the middle of the country, politically and, I believe, socially and culturally. Is that a fair assessment of why this race matters so much in the national consciousness? It's really the new Republican Party versus the old Democratic Party.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Hugh. There is this really weird way in which many of the folks who were voting for Democrats 30 years ago are now voting for Republicans. And probably at least, some of the people who were voting Republican 30 years ago are now voting Democrat. Of course, I'm trying to keep as many of those folks as possible. But there is a real realignment happening, where Obama won Ohio in 2012 by 3 points. I think there's a perception that Ohio has increasingly moved towards the political right because of a lot of these broader trends. And so, yes, I think that's why the beat is obsessed with it. I also think, the national media, for whatever reason, has always been obsessed with me, both when they liked me and also now that they hate me. So there's always been just a weird fascination with the story and with what it means for American politics. And so I think that, they're definitely turning their sights on the Ohio race.
They want you to lose so badly. If I asked my friends in Blue Bubble, D.C. and New York, who would you like to lose the most? They would say you, J.D. And the 100%. Reason, and it's because you embody the American opportunity dream, and you embody success, and you embody the Trump message amplified in the next generation of candidates. The president you get along, former president, you get along very well, even though you were a critic of his originally. I want to draw your attention to the New York Times yesterday, David Leonhardt. A crisis is coming. The twin threats to American democracy. David Leonhardt is a fine writer, but this is the most overwrought thing I've read in a long time. Do you think that American democracy is under threat, J.D.?
No, I don't think that it is. And very often what these people say or what they mean when they say American democracy is under threat is that the American Democratic, small D Democratic population is voting for candidates they don't like. And really, there is this weird idea in coastal blue bubble world, as you said, that if everybody just stopped paying attention to Donald Trump, and if everybody ignored Donald Trump's voters and everybody voted the right way, then we would all just, you know, go back to sort of singing Kumbaya and being happy. And I think a lot of us out here are saying, no, actually, the reason why we have a Donald Trump phenomenon, the reason why we have a Republican Party, I think, moving in the direction that it is because we have serious structural problems. We have the rise of China. We have a new global world order that's growing in a very different way from what any of us really alive today have seen. And so there's a fundamental set of problems that we have to confront. That's why you see our politics in this, you know, this period of chaos and disarray. It's not because, you know, everything was fine and Donald Trump came along and screwed everything up. Donald Trump is the reaction to the fact that things weren't fine. And these people really have to wake up to that fact.
They do. And they have to stop complaining about things, as David does. The Supreme Court is now 6-3 ordinary American jurisprudence, originalism. And I know, J.D., you went to Yale. I went to Michigan. Our professors are left wing. But this Supreme Court is not radical. It's just simply originalist.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, so many of the issues where the Democrats are most angry, where the media is most angry, are issues where the Supreme Court has said, we're not getting involved in this anymore. We're going to force the elected branches to do their job. We're going to force, whether it's the state or the federal level. That's what a lot of the regulatory stuff is ultimately all about. That's, of course, what the Dobbs decision was all about, is people should make these decisions via their elected representatives. That's the heart of American democracy. And the fact that people see it as an assault on democracy just makes me wonder, what do they see? What's actually going on? I just don't get it, Hugh.
One last question on the blue bubble separation from America, and then I want to talk about inflation. On Friday, the New York Times had a story, privilege is in crisis. Look at our elite public private schools. Privilege is in crisis. Look at our elite private schools. In there is buried the statistic that in Manhattan, the average annual tuition for a private school is $58,000, JD. Is it any wonder that they have no idea what's going on in Warren and in Hamilton, Ohio, and in Dayton, Ohio, and in Toledo, Ohio?
No, it's not at all. And that's just, of course, an unbelievable statistic. I'm sort of shocked just to hear it on the phone now. You know, it's also, you know, rents are extraordinarily high all across the country. They're especially high in New York City. I do think that there's this weird way where people think that if they make $400,000 a year, they are actually the ones that are middle class, that they're the ones that are affected most by good or bad policies. And they don't realize there's a whole other country out there that is much more precarious and much more day-to-day than the people who write for the New York Times, the people who read the New York Times. And I do think that's the heart of what's going on here, is so many of the people who drive the public conversation, Hugh, they don't even know somebody who doesn't agree with them and who doesn't live like they do.
And they don't know anyone who is just racked by inflation. I go to the Wall Street Journal this morning,
exactly.
Front page. Electric bills soar across the country as winter looms. Rising natural gas prices are expected to make it more expensive to light and heat homes in the coming months. All right, JD, after inflation for food is up 13.4% year over year, after gas prices chewed up the family budget throughout the spring and to the end of the driving season, now the heating and electricity costs are going through. Isn't that the only issue in many respects other than crime and the border? Isn't that it?
It's certainly very much up there, Hugh. I mean, look, Biden gave a really disgraceful interview. I caught some clips of it on 60 Minutes yesterday where, you know, he effectively tried to claim some victory for saying that inflation had only crept up a little bit. Well, it crept up from an already very high level. It should be coming down, not creeping up. And importantly, the things that are most important to people, the things you just have to buy, shelter, food, energy, those are the things that are going up the most. And you're exactly right. If you're paying $58,000 a year for tuition, you maybe don't care about the fact that bacon has gone up a dollar a pound. But if you're not in that privileged environment, then you absolutely care about the fact that bacon has gone up a dollar a pound because it makes it harder to feed your family.
Let me play that clip. Cut number five.
First of all, let's put this in perspective. Inflation rate month to month was just an inch, hardly at all.
You're not arguing that 8.3 is good news.
No, I'm not saying it's good news, but it was 8.2 or 8.2 before. I mean, it's not. Maybe I can make it sound like all of a sudden, my God, it went to 8.2%.
J.D. Vance, all of a sudden it did go. It just went under. It's like concurrent with the Biden administration. It's unworldly.
It really is. I mean, it is astonishing what the CPI looked like in January of 2021 compared to what it looks like today. And of course, it really is their fault. I mean, they did two things. Of course, they crushed the American energy sector, which restricted supply and everything from energy, but also, you know, manufactured goods. You're from Warren, Ohio. Ask a steel manufacturer in Warren how possible it is to do their job without the natural gas that feeds their plants. And then they poured money on an economy that was supply restricted. Everybody said this was going to happen. Larry Summers, of course, said exactly this thing was going to happen. And of course it did. And now they're all like, well, you know, we've sort of got it under control. Or, you know, yeah, gas shot up to $5, but now it came down to $4. It's like, well, it's still $4 a gallon. It's still twice what it was when you guys took over.
So, J.D., let me close with resources. Your campaign website is what, jdvance.com?
That's right.
J.D. Vance, do you have the resources to match my friend Tim in the last 50 days?
You know, are we going to match Tim dollar for dollar? I don't know. I actually think there's a good chance that we will. We certainly have the resources necessary to get our message out. It really, the story of the summer, Hugh, was that the Democrats overwhelmed the state with money in an effort to make the state competitive. And I think our task now is to make sure that we correct the record, tell the truth, and tell the story over the next 2 months. We're certainly going to have the money we need to do that. I feel very good about where we are, Hugh, and I think we're going to win, and I don't think it's going to be that close.
I look forward to seeing you inside the Beltway, J.D. Vance. Always a pleasure. I appreciate it as well. J.D. agreed to my rules of the road, which they don't slag my friend Tim, but I do know he's going to win. J.D. is, and I appreciate your coming on. Thank you, J.D. Let me remind everyone, my rules of the road are, if I've worked with you, I'm not going to slag you on the air, whether it's been at Salem or NBC or the Washington, I'm just not going to. And if you're my friend, I'm not going to run you over either. But I'll still talk about the race, and J.D.'s going to win. That's why I can talk to Nina Totenberg on a Monday and Donald Trump on a Thursday, and I'm just fine with that because there's basic courtesies that go with being in journalism, which unfortunately have frayed online, but not on the air. From number one New York Times bestselling author Vince Flynn comes Oath of Loyalty. Mitch Rapp confronts a very different kind of killer in the explosive new thriller in the bestselling Vince Flynn series, written by Kyle Mills. In the game of politics, some ties must be severed, but the Oath of Loyalty can never be broken. Oath of Loyalty by Vince Flynn, now available wherever books are sold. Go buy it today. I had a chance to interview the author Kyle Mills, so go to my podcast to listen to that full interview. Oath of Loyalty by Vince Flynn.
Former President Trump says he, quote, can't imagine being indicted over his handling of classified documents after leaving office. And he warned of unrest if charges were brought.
I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
Today on a radio show, Mr. Trump warned that there would be, quote, big problems if he's indicted in the classified documents case.
If it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems.
You know that the legacy media will say you're attempting to incite violence with that statement. How do you respond to what will inevitably...
That's not inciting. I'm just saying what my opinion is. I don't think the people of this country would stand for it.
There was a statement today on a radio show with Hugh Hewitt, and listen to what Trump said there.
If it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems. I just don't think they'd stand for it. They will not sit still and stand for this ultimate of hoaxes.
Phil, the former president went on the radio today, and I just want to play what he said when asked what he thought would happen if he was indicted. Here it is.
I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems. I just don't think they'd stand for it.
So, George, on another note, the former president was on Hugh Hewitt's radio show today, and I want to play a portion of what he said when asked what would happen if he was indicted and if it would deter him from running for president again. So listen to this.
I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems. I just don't think they'd stand for it.
Senator Durbin there undoubtedly referring to statements made by the ex-president, who just a few hours ago made this threat to radio host Hugh Hewitt on what will happen if he's indicted.
I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems.
Today, Trump, in an interview, was asked about the possibility he could get charged. And here's some of what he had to say.
Do you feel like the Department of Justice is trying to indict you, Mr. President?
Well, there is no reason that they can. I did absolutely, you've seen the legal papers, absolutely nothing wrong. I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems, big problems.
It comes as the former president is striking a defiant tone in a radio interview today. A month after the unprecedented search of his Mar-a-Lago home, the FBI saying they seized more than 11,000 government documents, including 100 that were marked classified. Today, Mr. Trump saying he verbally declassified every document he had taken with him to Mar-a-Lago.
I have the absolute right to declassify. Absolute. A president has that absolute right.
The Post has new reporting on the dozens of other January 6 subpoenas that were issued over the last week. The Post says it reviewed three of the subpoenas, which covered, quote, 18 separate categories of information, including any communications the recipients had with scores of people in six different states where supporters of then-President Trump sought to promote what are known as alternate electors. Today, Trump, in an interview, was asked about the possibility he could get charged. And here's some of what he had to say.
Do you feel like the Department of Justice is trying to indict you, Mr. President?
Well, there is no reason that they can. I did absolutely, you've seen the legal papers, absolutely nothing wrong. I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
Former President Donald Trump doubling down in a new interview, claiming the documents seized from Mar-a-Lago were declassified, and he, quote, can't imagine being indicted.
I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
Okay, so also something that may be tied potentially to this funding measure is the so-called Respect for Marriage Act about marriage equality. And so there's a question about whether forcing Republicans to vote against something when there's government funding all tied together. Hugh Hewitt wrote about this in the Washington Post, an opinion piece. He says, for Democrats, the Respect for Marriage Act is about elections. He says, calculation is, by Schumer, that even if he can't find the 60 votes he needs, it's always better for his party's chances in November if it's caught trying to pass the measure. So he says there are no state legislatures even making a peep about this issue. It is settled. Is this a cynical political ploy?
All right. Well, this argument will continue, and particularly at the state level and now at the federal level. I want to switch topics here because Donald Trump called into the radio show of conservative Hugh Hewitt. And Hewitt asked him, if he is indicted in the DOJ probe, would that deter him from running for president again? Take a listen.
I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it. I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before.
You know that the legacy media will say you're attempting to incite violence with that statement. How do you respond to what will inevitably...
That's not inciting. I'm just saying what my opinion is.
Liz, I thought Hugh Hewitt did a good job of trying to pin down Donald Trump. Hewitt said, I don't think they're going to stop until they indict you. But as much as the media may not like it, he may not be indicted.
I listened and I read the whole transcript of what Hugh Hewitt did. I actually didn't think he did a great job. He kind of let go once Donald Trump said, oh, I'm just making an observation. I'm not saying there should be violence. And I'm not sure where Ben's coming from in saying it won't result in riots.
And meanwhile, we have Donald Trump made some comments to Hugh Hewitt that were quite eerie, saying that terrible things will happen. There'll be big problems in the country if he is indicted. What's your sense of how worried how a message like that plays?
Former President Trump is warning of, quote, big problems in the United States if he is indicted for his mishandling of classified documents. Here's what he said, listen carefully, on the Hugh Hewitt Show yesterday.
You know the old saying, a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich if they want to. I'm just asking, if there is such a prosecutor and they indict you, would that deter you from running for president again?
I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it. And as you know, if a thing like that happened, I would have no prohibition against running. You know that. You've already.
I do. And that's what I want people to understand. That would not take you out of the arena.
It would not. But I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems. I just don't think they'd stand for it. They will not sit still and stand for this ultimate of hoaxes.
And he regularly walks just up to the line of making explicit threats. Just yesterday, he did it again, warning conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt of what could happen if he is indicted.
I'm just asking, if there is such a prosecutor and they indict you, would that deter you from running for president again?
I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it. And as you know, if a thing like that happened, I would have no prohibition against running. You know that. You've already.
I do. And that's what I want people to understand. That would not take you out of the arena.
It would not. But I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems. I just don't think they'd stand for it. They will not sit still and stand for this ultimate of hoaxes.
You know that the legacy media will say you're attempting to incite violence with that statement. How do you respond to what will inevitably...
That's not inciting. I'm just saying what my opinion is. I don't think the people of this country would stand for it.
There's a lot there, right? So notice how when Trump promises, quote, big problems, Hewitt understands that he is threatening violence. Right? Immediately. He knows what Donald Trump is saying, even though he's not part of the legacy media. He gives Trump the opportunity to walk that back, to protect himself, right? You want to say that? The ex-president, the subject of his interview. Because, of course, everyone who listens to that clip understands exactly what Trump means when he says big problems. He means there will be blood.
The former president himself did say that in an interview with Hugh Hewitt, saying he had this blanket declassification. They have not argued that in court, where if it were true, we would think that would be a pretty powerful argument to make to a judge about this search warrant. Something else the former president said in that interview has a lot of people gives unease. Listen.
If it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems. I just don't think they'd stand for it. They will not sit still and stand for this ultimate of hoaxes.
I want to turn to something we heard from former President Trump just yesterday when he was on Hugh Hewitt's show, and he was asked, you know, what would happen if you were indicted? Here's his response.
If it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems.
But even worse, we all know those lies can lead to real violence, and Trump seems to almost be counting on that if things don't go his way. In fact, here's how he responded just this week when asked about a possible indictment.
I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems. I just don't think they'd stand for it. They will not sit still and stand for this ultimate of hoaxes.
Let's play some reaction from Donald Trump. What he said, what he said would happen if he were indicted.
I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems. I just don't think they'd stand for it. They will not sit still and stand for this ultimate of hoaxes.
Big problems.
So Trump, remember him? He just did an interview about his political future, and he was asked about the possibility that the Justice Department will indict him. And here's what he said.
If there is such a prosecutor and they indict you, would that deter you from running for president again?
I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it. And as you know, if a thing like that happened, I would have no prohibition against running.
That would not take you out of the arena.
It would not. But I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think you'd have big problems. Big problems.
You know that the legacy media will say you're attempting to incite violence with that statement. How do you respond to what will inevitably...
That's not inciting. I'm just saying what my opinion is.
Speaking of Donald Trump's comments, take a listen to something that the former president told Hugh Hewitt about what might happen if he were ultimately indicted.
If it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think you'd have big problems. Big problems.
And, you know, Basil, it's a day that ends in Y. So we know Donald Trump is complaining about efforts to hold him accountable for what he's done. The former president had to say this when he was asked by Republican radio host Hugh Hewitt what would happen if he was indicted. Let's take a listen.
I think if it happened, I think you'd have problems in this country, the likes of which perhaps we've never seen before. I don't think the people of the United States would stand for it.
What kind of problems, Mr. President?
I think they'd have big problems. Big problems. I just don't think they'd stand for it. They will not sit still and stand for this ultimate of hoaxes.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.